condensed, throughout condensed matter physics, with two things that I guess I have to say in addition. One is that the denominators that you get often go through zero, so the I epsilon that appeared in the denominators, in the denominator on the blackboard before, becomes important and has to be the has you have to handle carefully what happens as you go through the singularities in the denominators. And the other is that there is not a entirely unique connection between the Lagrangian that starts the problem and the diagrammatic expansion that you use. Nature gives you something unique, but the diagrammatic expansion you use varies depending upon the phase, that is, the thermodynamic phase that you're in. One uses a different diagrammatic expansion, for example, for a normal non-superconducting metal and a superconductor. You use a different diagrammatic expansion to describe a quark gluon plasma and a one in which the quarks are totally bound. The diagrammatic expansion depends on the nature of the ground state, and that in the case that was considered 15 minutes ago, the ground state is believed to be known uniquely, but in other cases you have to first get the ground state and then go on from there. I have heard that I went too rapidly through the diffusion process in the last lecture. Yes, I wanted to make up for lectures that I wasn't going to have time to give, but I will go through it again. However, I'm going to go through it now that I have been asked in a rather different fashion. The content will be the same, but I will pretend I'm a mathematician. The pretense is not entirely silly. I've had appointments in the math department. But it is pretty silly since I don't know how to prove theorems. However, I will describe to you how this would work in a more mathematical vein. We started out with a displacement, x, which was the sum from j equals 1 up to m of sigma j times a lattice constant a, and I'm going to leave the lattice constant out, our working units in which that lattice constant is equal to 1. Now I will make use of the central limit theorem, which I said I was using last time, but I never really stated any form of the central limit theorem with any precision. Given M, I, D, D variables, sigma J. Now, what does IDD mean? It's a phrase often used in statistical analysis. It is IID. Okay? It is independent and identically distributed variables. That is, these sigma J's are uncorrelated with one another, and they have the same probability distribution, each one. With average expectation value of sigma j and variance VAR, sigma j squared, variance sigma j. Put right out the word. Then, x, which is the sum of these variables, is, in the limit as n goes to infinity, a Gaussian random variable with mean expectation value of x is m times the expectation value of sigma j. And variance m times the variance of sigma j. This is a weak form of the central limit theorem. You don't have to have these variables being independently and identically distributed. You need to have, however, the variance of each one of these variables being less than infinity, implied by my writing down the variance here as existing. You have to have the variance being less than infinity. You have to have the average exist. You have to have a few other properties to make this theorem true. The central limit theorem here is the statement of what we need in order to get the properties we stated of the random walk x. In particular, I ought to, however, tell you sort of how to prove this central limit theorem. And here I'll go back to my, to some extent, to my hat as a physicist. I will show you some indication of how a proof of this kind might go. And you can carry it forward yourself. Consider. The difficulty of reading a mathematics paper, as you know, is all hidden in this word, consider, which might be replaced by let. And then they tell you to do something, look at something. Let capital lambda equal e to the I q x. There. No motivation whatsoever. I won't give you any motivation either. And then you note that the expectation value of lambda is, because of the independence of these variables, the expectation value of e to the I q. Q is a real number, sum over j of sigma j. And since these guys are independent of one another, it is also true that this is e to the I q sigma j raised to the mth power. I'm sorry, there should be a sum here. This is the sum over j equals 1 to m. Of the, oh, it is there. I wrote it down correctly. J equals 1 to M. This is then this e to the I qj raised to the mth power. You can, I will fill in more details in a moment. Is what I have done here clear? In a previous lecture, I discussed how you take a Fourier transform of this kind of thing. This is some function of q raised to the mth power. And we're working in the limit as m goes to infinity. The probability that the random variable x, or the probability distribution, that the random variable x will have the value small x is the Fourier transform of this thing. It is the integral dq e to the minus iq small x times e to the iq capital X average integral from minus infinity to infinity. And I believe there's a 2 pi there. Well, I won't actually, but since I didn't exactly come prepared, I'm not exactly sure about the 2 pi. The reason for that is, this is a small x, this is a capital X. The reason for that is that this Fourier transform projects out the value of capital X equal to small x, and that gives us the probability distribution. Are you willing to bite on that? I've more or less said that before. Once you're willing to bite on that, the integral converts into the integral dq over 2 pi, e to the minus iq times small x, times this f of q raised to the mth power. Limit as m goes to infinity. Now, being I put the mathematics hat back on and say, as we have previously shown, as we previously said in a slide which said how you calculate integrals like this for large m, you take the maximum as a function of q, expand as yes, as a, you take the maximum of the more or less the exponent, the maximum value of f of q raised to the mth power. You expand around that maximum and treat this blessed thing as a Gaussian integration. In fact, if you look at the notes, not what I said in class, with the notes, I do this with the case sigma is plus or minus 1, in which case f of q is cosine q. And this calculation goes through as the Fourier transform of cosine q. However, it is far easier to do the calculation in general than it is to do it with a particular value of f. At least I think it is. I, as I say, didn't come in prepared to do this calculation. And I'm all of a sudden wondering how I take care of the expectation value of sigma. But I know how I take care of that. And it's all OK. Yes. Okay, I have a tiny bit of trouble with this expectation value of sigma. The way I will handle that expectation value of sigma is that I will write f of q, which is the expectation value of e to the iq times sigma j, as the as e to the iq times the expectation value of sigma j times the expectation value of e to the iq sigma j minus the average of sigma j. Good. Now I understand how to do the calculation. This average, which is, the whole thing is called f. This average has as its maximum value the value at q equals 0. At q equals 0, this is the average of 1, which everyone knows as 1. And for every other value of q, this is an average of a cosine of something or other. A cosine is always less than 1. Therefore, its average is always less than 1. Therefore, for every other value of q, it is smaller than the value at q equals 0. So f of q, this part of f of q, has its maximum at an absolute value at q equals 0. This thing is purely, since sigma has, by implication, and now I say explicitly, sigma is a real variable. It has only real values. This thing it has is sigma average is real. This thing has magnitude 1. Therefore, the magnitude of f of q is biggest at q equals 0. F of q, yes, question? Sigma might take out all kinds of values. It doesn't have to be integer value. This is not necessarily periodic in Q. It might be periodic in Q. Thank you for telling me about that. I guess I can better deal with that somehow. And I worry. If sigma j has integer values, I have multiple maxima. Okay. I'm worried. I'm assuming that, I will assume that this problem away. I will assume that sigma j doesn't just have integral values, that it's distributed, so it doesn't. If it did have integral values, I probably would want to go and make this integral from minus pi to pi and limit myself that way. If it's distributed over all kinds of real values, I go from minus infinity to infinity. But you caught me. I am caught. The referee got me. I got to go back and rewrite the paper. Okay. So now I'm going to assume a single maximum. I'm going to notice that because sigma j has a finite variance, that maximum is analytic in Q. That is, that f of Q near Q equals 0 is approximately equal to e to the I Q sigma j. And this term has the average of e to the I Q times sigma minus sigma j is 1. And then we get e to the minus q squared over 2 times sigma j minus the expectation value of sigma j squared, which is the variance of sigma j. And then we get higher order terms plus dot, 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 dot. I just did an expansion of this thing in Q, looking around the Q equals 0, and then put the result of the expansion back in the exponential. If I assume that the plus dot, 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 dot is small, as I said I should for doing integrals of this kind as m goes to infinity, I then get a result which is e to the minus q minus, I get a result of a quadratic form in q. Quadratic form, I'm sorry, in x, proving that the probability distribution is Gaussian. Now, the content of all of this is this central limit theorem that says that if you got lots, if you're adding up lots of variables, they give you a Gaussian, then x must be Gaussian. Therefore, the diffusion process must be Gaussian. Therefore, you must have what I said we had in the last lecture. This is, I think, pretty clear. I'm not sure that the physics of the diffusion is entirely clear, although I think that the derivation of the diffusion equation itself, that is via the currents and all that kind of stuff, is pretty straightforward and done at a reasonable pace. Do you have questions about this or comments? Do you have do you want to ask questions about the physics of it all? Yes, please.
Is the model, the Gaussian model, the only model for the diffusion process?
I showed that
Two, but let me remind you how I showed it, since I can make big noises about it. I need to black. I'm going to erase my wickedness here. So we looked at the equation in which we had rho of x and c was equal to lambda times the second derivative with respect to x of rho of x and c. This was derived as a consequence of diffusion. Now I'm going to tell you something about the solution to this equation. I'm going to start out with a particle at x equals 0. That gives, I'm not sure, I don't remember the notation I used last time, but that gives a Fourier transform of rho. I'll call rho tilde the Fourier transform of rho. Rho tilde of k is 1. The solution I claimed last time was rho of x and t is the integral dk over 2 pi rho tilde of k, e to the I k x, e to the minus lambda, e to the I k, k x, yes, e to the minus lambda t times k squared. If rho tilde is equal to 1, this integral is just the Fourier transform I described a second ago, and has the form e to the minus x squared divided by t with a lambda someplace there and a 2 there and a normalization there. That's the result of doing this integration. That is called the Gaussian function of x. Therefore, the question you asked has an affirmative answer. Yes. This is the long form of the answer. The short form is yes. The consequence of the diffusion equation is, though that's not quite correct, I didn't remember your question correctly. The consequence of the diffusion equation and a particle starting out at x equals 0 is a Gaussian distribution for all times thereafter. However, you asked me the converse question, I believe. If I get a Gaussian distribution, can I be sure that I've satisfied the diffusion equation? No, that's, you can't. The Gaussian can come out of lots of different equations. But the diffusion equation uniquely implies a Gaussian. From diffusion, you get out Gaussian. Okay? Clear? Maestro, may we have the lights on, slides on or something? Okay. I'll stand here for a moment. Oh, well, I can tell a joke. once upon a time, long ago and far away, I took a quantum mechanics course from a man by the name of Julian Schwinger.
Now, Schwinger and Feynman and Tamanaga were the three people who invented quantum electrodynamics. Feynman, as you know, in 1943 or so, invented Feynman diagrams as a way of describing what was going on. I got my graduate training from Schwinger. Now, physicists are rather competitive folks sometimes. In fact, I never saw a Feynman diagram in my entire time in graduate school. Schwinger never wrote them, and all of the other guys who were teaching were sufficiently respectful of Schwinger, so that they never wrote one down. A man by the name of Kurt Gottfried, who's now just retired as a professor at Cornell, took me aside just before I went off into the world to be a postdoc and said, you know, in the rest of the world, they describe things like this by using Feynman diagrams. Here's what they are, and a lecture somewhat like the lecture you just heard was given to me. Everybody uses Feynman diagrams, except, of course, Schwinger did not. I don't know what Tamanaga did. I assume Tamanaga used Feynman diagrams. Okay. This picture is to emphasize the unity of physics. At the end of the, almost the end, of the series of lectures on, that's going to be on hopping processes in momentum, I'm going to write down what is called the Boltzmann equation. And the Boltzmann equation looks at scattering processes in which particles with, it's the wrong scattering process, but sort of, okay, let's look up here. Particle with momentum P and comes, scatters off of a particle with momentum Q and produces particles with momentum P prime and Q prime. Except that I don't fill in the box of what happens there, I might just as well have a Feynman diagram for describing what's going on. I'm going to do classical physics, and I'm not going to tell you what happens inside the box, but I'm going to do pretty much the same physics in terms of probabilities as you saw in terms of amplitudes in the last lecture. Come on, go backwards. Okay. So, here we are, we're starting out talking about the behavior of momentum in classical mechanics and how eventually, at the end, we're going to derive the Boltzmann distribution. At the beginning of this course, in lecture zero, I just simply wrote down the Boltzmann distribution, Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, e to the minus beta h, and asked that you accept it. I didn't tell you where it came from. I told you it came from Boltzmann and Maxwell, and those guys are famous, and you should believe it. You've got to do a lot of that kind of stuff for physics. When I was, that's not good news. Good news at all. Did I bring any one of my, no, I didn't bring. I wasn't expecting that to happen. Why did it happen? This is likely to go back on. I have a problem with the computer. The battery is not as young as it should be. And if left unattended, and I didn't plug this in right, if left unattended for an appropriate period of time, goes down. Yes, but there. my fingers. The light here is green, it should be orange. That's not the best news in the world, but we'll go on. Okay, so we'll take as much of this as the gods give us, and if the gods turn us off, we will go back and do something else. Okay. In 1905, Einstein famously wrote a bunch of important papers. Not the least important of these papers was a paper about Brownian motion, which is the following physical thing. You take a sort of big particle, piece of pollen is the usual thing, and you look at it under the microscope. You notice that it is dancing around. And you interpret what you're seeing by saying that the molecules in the material are bumping in, or the molecules in the fluid are bumping into that piece of pollen and producing this jiggling motion, which is called Brownian motion. Question is, can you explain it? And if you explain it, will you have any connection to what we do in statistical mechanics? I will go through a series of discussions in this lecture and the next one, and maybe the next one, in which I derive the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution from a model which is originally due to Einstein, and I will derive it more and more generally as we go through. The model starts out with the statement that I have perhaps a potential in which I'm moving the particle. That's the dot, dot, dot. But I have two things that refer specifically to the Brownian motion. I have a random force. Molecules are hitting the thing from random directions at random times. I will represent that by a random force, eta of t. I will then say that in addition to the random force, which tends to make the molecule jiggle more and more, I have an extra term, p over t. This is a momentum p. P over tau, I'm sorry. Tau is a relaxation time and tends to slow the molecule down. What would happen if I didn't have this p over tau term? No potential, no nothing. dp dt is just random kicks. Yep, right on, thank you. That is, this is just exactly the same thing as we talked about before. Just the name of the variable has has been changed to confuse the innocent. The variable might be a three momentum, px, py, pz, and the random function might have three components, eta x, eta y, eta z. In Einstein's work, the average of the eta at any time was zero, and the average of the product of the two etas was a delta symbol, saying that you had to have the same components, delta jk, a delta function in time, saying that the etas at different times were uncorrelated, and a strength of the random kick called gamma. Same physics in eta and tau. Eta kicks the particle. However, as the particle is randomly kicked, that kicking also tends to slow it down, because if the particle is moving fast in this direction, there are more kicks on this side, and then those kicks tend to slow it down. So the same physics is in eta and tau, and we will describe that in a moment. Is the model clear? Okay. Something happened very rapidly in between the last slide and this one, and so I better put it on the board. For one thing, I went down to one dimension. There's no reason why we shouldn't have three dimensions. It's just easier for me to work in one. The equation which I'm solving is that dp dt is eta of t minus p of t divided by tau. I solve such equations sort of in my head. That's the solution to that equation. If you plug in, you will find that it is indeed the solution to that equation. It involves an integral over eta at previous times. The result is weighted with an exponential, which says that if you go back far enough in time, if t prime is very, very negative, then the slow it down term here, this friction term, tends to make the effect of eta small. Are you willing to accept this as a solution of that equation? Because p of t is the sum of many random variables according to the central limit theorem, you now know what the central limit theorem is, p of t must be a Gaussian random variable. Therefore, it has a Gaussian probability distribution, of course. In equilibrium, p of t should have the variance mkt, with k being the Boltzmann constant, t the temperature, and m being the mass of the particle. In equilibrium, it will then have the Maxwell-Boltzmann probability distribution. We now have in front of us, for the first time, the derivation of something or other which has to do with the Boltzmann distribution, e to the minus beta p squared. It doesn't quite work. We haven't quite gotten there yet. We have to calculate the variance in p of t to make sure that the variance has the right value, beta over m, to make sure the variance has the right value in order to make sure that this is the right answer. The structure here is right. We don't yet know the coefficient. Notice that if this works out, it'll be our first proof, in quotation marks, that the idea of Gibbs, Boltzmann, and Maxwell about the canonical distribution being the name for e to the minus beta p times the Hamiltonian, was correct. So we would have a proof that this law works, at least in this situation. In physics, we often use laws long before there's any substantial proof that they're correct. We use little bits of evidence, intuition, and guesswork, and gradually convince ourselves that X might be right. Must be right? Well, it's written here, must be right. If X is attractive, we hold on to that view until there's overwhelming evidence that this thing is wrong. Okay, so there we are. I now have to calculate the variance of p of t, make sure it works out to the right value, so that when I get the variance of p of t, when I plug into the Gaussian distribution, I get everything out right. So here is p of t. We calculate p of t at time t, p of t at time s, and as distinct from what I said, I'm holding on to indices, so I have a j and a k here for the jth component and the kth component. P of t is an integral over this is the answer I would have gotten with a no friction term. I don't know what this is doing on this slide. The right answer has the friction term, so I'm going to write out the right answer here, and ask you to ignore for the moment what's on the slide. We want to calculate the expectation value of the P J of T times P K of S average. This is the average of the integral over earlier times. I'm going to use for earlier times the symbols U and V. From U goes from minus infinity up to T. V goes from minus infinity up to S. P of T is eta J of U. E to the minus T minus U over tau. This P is eta K of V. And we have an e to the minus s minus v over tau. What I did was simply substitute the values of eta from the last slide, equation v3, into the expression for the expectation values. I wrote down everything right, except I need expectation value sign around everything. The average of the eta's, and now I think I have it right on the slide, but I'll write it again. So we get once again the integral du. We get once again the integral du dv minus infinity up to s minus infinity up to t. We get a delta function of u minus v because of the eta's having a having a delta function distribution. We get a gamma, which is the weight. We get a delta jk. And we get an e to the minus t minus u s minus v, all divided by tau. And we have to calculate that integral. Now I can pass over my errors. This formula is correct. It is the same as the thing on that board. And the delta function requires u equals to v. So I can do the one integral. I will do the u integral. I'm going to assume t is greater than s. Then the u integral will always get a contribution. I will get, no, I'm going to assume t is greater than s. If t is greater than s, then the integral over u will always get a contribution. And we will then get down to an integral over v, the integral dv. Gamma times delta jk times this exponential. Calculate the exponential, delta jk, because this is 2v, we get a factor of 2 there. We get a gamma, with this tau becomes that tau, and we get the expectation value. We get the exponential of t minus s over tau. Okay, this is not of precisely the structure that we want. We want to have a value in which this thing, p squared over 2m, is equal over 2m, has the value kt. Instead, it's gamma times tau divided by 4m from this formula. That is, we set t equals s here, we set j equals to k, and we find gamma times tau, and this 2m becomes this 4m because of that too. This is the thing we want to set equal to kt, and that means there is a relationship between gamma and tau. I'm glad there's a relationship between gamma and tau, because I claimed at the beginning there were different representations of the same physics. In fact, we set gamma over times tau is 2mkt, and we get then the correct variance for p squared, the correct value p squared over 2m average is going to be equal to 1/2 p squared, that's one of the 1/2 kt. Yes. This is a quadratic degree of freedom. Every quadratic degree of freedom has, in classical mechanics, a average energy. Here's the average. Here's the energy. Here's the average of 1/2 kt. We set this equal to 1/2 kt, and we're home free. Home free means that we have a relationship between gamma and tau, and we have, for the first time in this course at least, a derivation of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And that's what this slide ought to say. The probability distribution. Whenever this relationship for gamma times tau is satisfied, p has the right variance and the right Maxwell-Boltzmann probability distribution. What do I say about more generally? More generally, we said that if we have a Hamiltonian, which is a function of p and r, the probability distribution is the exponential of e to the minus beta h of p of r divided by a single particle partition function. And in the simplest case, h of p and r is vector p squared over 2m plus u of r, where u is a potential which holds the thing in the box. We have a box. Maxwell and Boltzmann expected that in appropriate circumstances, if they waited long enough, a Hamiltonian system would get to equilibrium, and they would end up with a probability distribution that looked like this. Okay, now we come to a question which is a big deal question. Should we not be able to derive this distribution from classical mechanics alone? Maybe all we have to do is wait long enough and we get this distribution out just from waiting long enough and using the equations of classical mechanics. Well, out there we have a pool table. And the pool table, we can say, is described by classical mechanics. We have to take the friction out of the pool table so that if we have a ball bouncing like this, if we're going to be looking for an equilibrium distribution, it should bounce back and back and back again and just keep on going, doing the same thing again and again and again, never deviating from the path it started from. Well, that doesn't look much like e to the minus beta h of p and r. If we have the pool table and we started bouncing it off like that, it would nonetheless continue to bounce off of one cushion or other cushion, and if there were no friction, it would just continue to bounce over the same path forever. Beep, 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 beep. That doesn't look like that either. What's going on here? Classical mechanics alone, as we see it on a pool table, is not enough to derive the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. You have to have a stochastic element, a random element. In the Brownian motion, the random element was that you had little molecules coming in and at sort of random times and directions hitting a Brownian particle. Well, I'm claiming that that Hamiltonian mechanics is not enough in the long run. Let me justify that claim. Let me solve the equations of Hamiltonian mechanics, at least in, let me solve the equations of Hamiltonian mechanics, at least in some general form, and then show you that it's not enough. Okay, there are the equations of Hamiltonian mechanics. There are variables p and q. The time derivative of a q variable is the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to a p variable. The derivative of the p variable with respect to time is minus the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to the q variable. I'm going to assume that the Hamiltonian has no explicit time dependence. This is the simplest form of the Hamiltonian. In the simplest form, we get out these results. Everything on this slide is familiar to you. The statistical mechanics of such situations is given by a probability density function, rho of p, rt, such that the probability of finding the particle, the volume element, dp dr, about pr at time t is rho of prt dp dr. The next question is, what is the time dependence of this probability density? According to what we might hope for, if we started out with this stuff and waited long enough, rho of p and r might look like e to the minus beta h. However, our experience with the pool table suggests that that just isn't so. Maxwell and Boltzmann knew that that wasn't so. Let me show you in a way that it, let me show you in a way which is quite explicit that we cannot get the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution out of classical mechanics. I'm about to start a big deal argument about how one derives an equilibrium distribution function. I'm not going to get very far into that argument today. I'm just going to set it up, and then we will, next time, get the results we need. And convince ourselves that the pool table was right all along, that we need more than just classical mechanics in order to get statistical mechanics. What I'm going to do is consider the world's most general dynamical system. I'm going to consider a variable x, which has a time dependence t, and I'm going to write dx dt is capital X there, so I might as well put a capital X here. Some function called the velocity, which is a function of x of t and t. If there are enough indices here, let's call it j, j. This is all the indices. If there are enough indices here, this is the most general dynamical system you ever heard of. And then I will formally solve for an equation for the probability that rho of x equals small x, which is the product over all j of the delta function of xj minus x. And since xj depends on t, this is a row of x and t. I'm going to then write down an equation for this probability distribution, just like I got this probability distribution on the board here. I'm going to write down an equation for this probability distribution, find out its time dependence, go to classical mechanics, find out the time dependence of rho of p and q, and find out that although Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution is one solution to the equation for the time dependence in classical mechanics, that there are zillions of other solutions, and that the solution of Maxwell and Boltzmann was not in any way picked out by the laws of classical mechanics, just as the distribution of Maxwell and Boltzmann is not in any way picked out by starting a ball moving on the pool table. Then we will add back in a stochastic element, first by using Einstein's little calculation, and then by using a calculation due to Boltzmann, and finally, do something that's not in the notes at the moment, make a much more general argument, which is a generalization of Boltzmann's argument. The Einstein argument and the Boltzmann argument will give the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. The generalization will give us some insight into why that works. So we're going to be working for the next few days on deriving the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Questions or comments?
Okay. No, I'm going to take it just a little further. I have an hour and 15 minutes. I got another 12 minutes. I can set up the equipment. So instead of carrying around P and R, I'm going to use X. I already said that.
And what I'm going to do is calculate this average by using the equation of motion for the x's, and then using the equation which says that the average of any function of the x's at time t, any function of the x's at time t, is equal to the integral over small x of rho of x and t times g of x. That's just a definition of how you use rho to calculate averages. Then we're going to, in effect, use this equation of motion to calculate the time dependence of rho. And using that equation for the time dependence of rho, we will specialize to classical mechanics. So we start from this equation of motion, and we notice that if we step forward through the infinitesimal time dt, x steps forward by this much. No big deal. The average at time t plus dt of some g of x is also the integral dx g of x times rho of x t plus dt. Also not a big deal. That's what you mean by looking forward by a time dt from t in rho. So we have this relationship, which we will then be able to use to calculate the time dependence of rho. The reason I'm doing it this way, instead of calculating the time dependence of rho directly from this definition in terms of delta function, is a general reason why one should be used, one should approach the time dependence or the dependence of things which have complicated transformation properties. If you have some fancy tensor in general relativity, you could either calculate the transformation properties of that tensor in some direct fashion, or you can form a scalar from that tensor and use the known trivial transformation properties of the scalar to calculate the behavior of the tensor. That's what g mu nu is for. Yes?
Of g of x at the small at the time t plus delta t, why are you assuming that the function that you want to average is not changing for that small time t?
Because that's how I define the function. I didn't put in any explicit time dependence. The function I want to calculate is like x squared. If I wanted to do x squared times 2t, if I wanted g of x to be x squared, I wouldn't put any explicit time dependence. If I wanted x squared times 2t, which is another possible thing to calculate, I'd have to do that explicitly. What I'm assuming is that the partial derivative of g of x and t with respect to t is zero. That all of the time dependence comes from x. I can't tell you how much trouble I've had at various times in my life with exactly this sort of question. Partial derivatives and total derivatives are a total pain in the neck. And that's just the right question to ask. So I think I answered. G is defined so that it is time independent. G is something like x squared. This is something we are going to use in order to generate a scalar, which we can then use to calculate the time dependence of rho. So I will go on one more slide. And I just wrote down the equation once again at the top of this slide for what we do at the time t plus dt. The next line down, I expand this equation to first order in dt. I'm following the approach that we don't worry about the rather tricky transformation properties of rho in time, that we just follow our nose by looking at this simple definition of what rho does. And we then expand in dt. Here we take the partial derivative of rho of x and t plus dt. This is the partial derivative of rho with respect to time. Why do I take the partial derivative there? Well, rho depends on two things. Rho depends on x, small x, that is where you look, and it depends on the time at which you're looking. And now this part of the equation has to do with the dependence of rho on the time in which we're looking. That's the expansion of this side of the equation in dt. We expand this side of the equation in dt, and we say that G has an X which develops in time in this fashion, and then we take the time development of G. Here we then taking the derivative of G with respect to X times V, which is the time development of G. And we now have terms in dt. We can balance one side of the equation against the other. If I forget about the terms in blue, which are the same, take the terms multiplying dt, cancel out the dt, move this over to the left-hand side of the equation, I get the integral dx, g of x times the partial derivative of rho of x and t, and then the integral dx velocity, v of x t, partial derivative with respect to x of g of x times rho of x and t. G is a device for calculating. I can have any properties I want for G. Unlike what I wrote on the board with G being x squared, I'm going to want G to go very rapidly to zero as x goes to infinity. So I can go backwards, silly. So I can do a partial, so I can integrate by parts here. I integrate by parts here, and this minus sign turns into a plus sign. I get an integral dx, a derivative with respect to x of v times rho here, and everything is multiplied by g. G is arbitrary. It's anything I want it to be, just so long as it vanishes rapidly enough as x goes to infinity. Therefore, the thing in curly brackets here must be 0. Therefore, the rho of x and t, quite generally, must satisfy dt rho plus dx v of x and t times rho equals 0. This equation is funny in two ways. I have just enough time to say that it is funny in two ways. The time derivative of g of x, and which depends on t, is the partial derivative of g with respect to x times v, partial derivative of total derivative, times the derivative of x with respect to t, which is v. V appears on the right-hand side of the equation. Partial derivative of g is v times the derivative with respect to x of g. Here, v appears on the left-hand side of the equation. That's one difference between the equation for rho and the equation for g. The other difference between the equation for rho and the equation for g is this extra term, which comes from, it's called the divergence term. It's this derivative acting on that. It describes the change in the, describes the dilation, the growth or squeezing of the volume element by the changes in x caused by the time development. That is the volume element pi over j dxj, which is implicitly in the definition of a rho. Since the probability, which is a scalar, has the dx's in it, where it's rho times dx, the probability density is not a scalar and obeys an equation with a dilation term like that in it. It describes the dilation of the volume element by the changes in the x's caused by the time development. This last term is the direct result of the time change in each coordinate x of t. Now we have the general result for the time development of the probability density in any system in which we have any dynamical system in which we have x's varying in time. And we can go on and specialize to the case of classical mechanics. And now I have reached the end of my hour, and so I will quit. And next time we go do classical mechanics, we show that Maxwell and Boltzmann do not, their distribution is not the only possible result of classical mechanics, that there is a much wider class of results. And then we put stochastic elements in order to specialize to the Maxwell-Boltzmann results. Questions, comments? Yes, please.
Does the comment on G being arbitrary, you already said that G should be chosen such that it should vanish at infinity.
Yes.
But yet you say G is arbitrary. So if I take another G, if it's arbitrary, I take another G, it does not vanish.
What I have to use G for is I have to be able to cancel G out of this equation. G is used in order to go from this equation to this equation. G can be very general stuff at this level. It, however, can't I said something which, in fact, I needn't have said and shouldn't have said. Thank you, you put me in an error. I have to be able to integrate by parts in this equation in order to get the derivative off of the G. There are two ways in which I can do that. I can let G go to zero rapidly enough to infinity. Or I can let rho go to zero rapidly enough at infinity. If I then look at a situation in which these x's are not entirely general, but instead are confined to some region of space and don't go all the way out to infinity, I can still do what I said I could. So I can do what I said if rho goes down as fast as 1 over x cubed, even if g goes up as fast as x squared, goes down faster than 1 over x cubed. So I can do it. I just have to keep my eye on it. And I don't make any substantial error. At least I don't think I make any substantial error in going along this way. I have to remember the conditions that I used. This is a very general thing. And in classical mechanics, we don't want our momentum to go to infinity. We put things in a box. We don't let our particles go to infinity. And if we do, we have to be a little careful. Okay? Further questions? Okay, lunchtime.